Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And did you know, well, you would if you were listening last week's show, but did you know it's 40 years since man walked on the moon? Well, we go to the moon with Harrison Smith, the only scientist to make the journey. Yes, we have more of Harrison's talk, some of which we heard last week. Here's a little teaser to put you in the mood. And Harrison Smith sang that song as he, moonwalked, is I guess the word to use, across the lunar surface from the LSEP deployment site over to where the lunar module was in preparation for their first drive away on the lunar roving vehicle. More about that trip later. On the Space Show tonight, we are going to be having another look at Apollo 17. This is the second of three programs devoted largely, but not entirely, to the Apollo 17 mission. The Apollo 17 was the final manned lunar landing in the Apollo series, and it followed six manned flights in the Mercury spacecraft, each carrying one man, 10 manned flights in the Gemini program, carrying two men, and then numerous unmanned flights of the Apollo systems, 10 orbital unmanned flights, and then came Apollo 7, which went into Earth orbit in 1968 October. The first people into lunar orbit but not landing were the crew of Apollo 8 in 1968 December, followed by an Earth orbital mission in Apollo 9 that checked out the lunar module and the manoeuvres necessary to make that work. Then Apollo 10 went back to the moon, again orbited the moon but did not land, and tested the lunar module in lunar orbit. And then there was Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15 and 16, which landed on the moon, and Apollo 13, which was the subject of that famous Ron Howard movie. Apollo 13 had an accident on the way to the moon and what became cislunar, meaning it swept around the backside of the moon and came right back to Earth. So here we are, 1972 December, with a lunar landing. The first scientist astronaut on board. The crew are Gene Cernan, the commander. Harrison Smith is the lunar module pilot and the scientist. And Ronald Evans is the command module pilot. He drew the short straw and remained in orbit around the moon. The flight lasted 301 hours and 52 minutes. They did three extravehicular activities on the moon, totaling 23 hours and 10 minutes. Many people don't realise that three of the Apollo missions did extravehicular activities on the way back from the moon, sort of midway, not exactly midway, but midway between the Earth and the moon. And that was to retrieve some film canisters that were in the service module of the command and service module. And that was had been taking photographs of the moon, and that EVA lasted 1 hour and 6 minutes. Well, we're going to just have a little snippet of sound here from the first extravehicular activity.
December 11, Cernan, then Schmidt left the lunar module to begin their first EVA.
As I step off at the surface at Torres Litoral, I'd like to dedicate the first step of Apollo 17 to all those who made it possible.
Their first job was to unload equipment, including their rover, the electric car in which they would drive to the exploration sites.
That's beautiful. This has got to be one of the most proud moments of my life, I guarantee you.
We thank you very much.
As Cernan drove the equipment-laden rover, Schmidt carried the scientific experiments package called LSEP.
Hey, do you need me, Gene? Nope. I'm going to go deploy an LSEP. Have at it.
In Houston,
Scientists in the science support room watched, correlating and directing their movements.
Okay, Bob, I've got my tools of the trade right here.
As Schmidt set up the various experiments, Cernan drilled a series of holes, both to collect core samples and to implant experimental probes.
And that was a little sample from the official documentary that NASA published about the Apollo 17 mission. Quite a nice little documentary if you want to seek it out. However, if you want the real McCoy, you got to shell out a bit of money and buy the 6-DVD set of the Apollo 17 mission. Now, Harrison Schmidt has visited Melbourne, and the space show caught up with him when he was here, and we recorded all three of his speeches. He gave three speeches here in Melbourne. We recorded all three of them. And tonight we are hearing more of the one we heard from last week on the show. And this is when he spoke to the Nepean group of Rotary International at the Mornington Peninsula Racecourse. And following the talk, which we did hear last week, Harrison consented to answer some questions, and here's how that question and answer session went.
Thank you for that remarkable address, Harrison. I couldn't help but notice in one of the final photographs the curtain rod. For those that saw a documentary on Australian television suggesting that the Apollo missions were a Hollywood fake, could you please explain to us the importance of the curtain rod in confounding the skeptics' view that because the flag remained unfurled in a weightless atmosphere, that it was all a Hollywood stunt?
Well, I think the main reason those kind of people appear to say those things is they want to get their mugs on television. But let me just tell you how the flag was packed and then what we did with it. Everything we took in really to the moon was vacuum packed, one way or the other, just in order to minimize the amount of space that they took up. Even our parachutes were vacuum packed. In fact, they had the density of wood. And if you ever saw them, as we did at various times during the test programs and everything, you would think they would never have deployed, because they literally looked like pieces of red and white wood packed away in the spacecraft. The flag was much the same way. It was packed in probably in a volume no more than my two hands put together. And when we deployed it in various tests, we realized that in that environment, that weightless environment, or near weightless, 1/6 gravity environment, that flag just was going to stay pretty much folded up and crinkled. So to make it look a lot better in the photographs, such as you've seen, that frankly was our purpose, to make it look good. We had a collapsible curtain rod that we put in the upper hem, and that held it out. So not only did it get rid of a lot of the major folds and wrinkles in the flag, to some people it made it look like it was waving in the breeze, even in a still photograph. Figure that one out. But at any rate, it was one of those things that seems very minor, but for us was very, very important. And by the way, one of the things that we did for our mission control friends, the first time Apollo 17 did it, was to take an American flag to the moon. And the flag that you now see in mission control, whenever they show it for the space shuttle flights and space station flights, is the flag that we took to the moon for the our friends in the mission control center.
One of the photographs shows of the Earth from the moon. There were no stars at all. Where did they go?
The question has to do with why are there no stars shown in the photographs of the Earth. The primary reason and the only reason is that the camera and its film, along with the human eye, do not have the dynamic range, which is the term of art, to see both an illuminated Earth or spacecraft or lunar surface and the stars. It's the same during the day, on a clear day, anywhere on Earth. You go outside, the stars are there, you can't see them. Unless you go down into a deep well, and then you can see some stars up at the well opening. It's just your eye is a remarkable optical instrument, but it's not that good. and nor are the cameras that good, and you just can't see them. Now, when we were behind the moon and could turn out all of the spacecraft lights and not have anybody jabbering at us, which we did several times, you could dark adapt and see this magnificent field of stars, certainly better than you would normally ever get to see here on Earth, except in extremely high mountain country. I suspect people standing on the top of Everest have had a comparable view of stars if they were there at night, but maybe even during the day. I'm not sure whether that's possible to do or not. Probably not. It's pretty bright up there. But in addition to that, we could watch sunrises, and they are spectacular from behind the mountain, believe me. The sun has all sorts of activity coming, streaming out away from it. There's the zodiacal light, the streamers that come from various eruptions on the solar surface. And then just before sunrise, each of those streamers has this brilliant jagged blade of light right in the middle of it. And then, of course, you need to look away. You don't want to be staring at the sun too long. Watching it rise in space. So the stars are there, you just can't see them because of the dynamic range of the instruments you have.
Next question.
Harrison, are you going to say anything about the samples that you're able to recover?
Well, I can give you, if you had several weeks, I can give you my lectures that I give at Wisconsin. And by the way, they're on the web if anybody wants them. Let me just give you a very, very short summary. That summary is that the samples that we retrieve from the moon, their analysis here on Earth, the additional data that has come from several automated or unmanned missions of the moon, Clementine, Lunar Prospector, and the like, have resulted since Apollo in a very detailed understanding of the history of the moon. A history that goes from about 4.6 billion years ago to the present, but a history mostly which was over at about 3 billion years ago. And the reason that's important to us here on Earth is that that's the part of Earth history that we have a devil of a time reading in the rocks of the Earth. We are getting a little bit smarter with that, partly because we have insights that we've gained from the moon, but primarily just because the Earth has been so active, volcanically, in terms of erosion of oceans and streams and the like, we just have lost that history here on Earth for the most part. And it's a very, very important part of our history because that's the time, that period from about 4.6 billion years ago to about 3.8 billion years ago when life was evolving on this planet. And we just, until we went to the moon, had no insight into what the history or what the environment of the early solar system was like during that period of time. And now we do know. The moon has told us that. What was happening on the moon clearly was happening on the Earth, but in a very water-rich environment. And those insights have been absolutely fundamental to a lot of the discussion we now have about the origins of life. And in fact, there was a conference in Hamilton Island when we first got here. It was the first couple of events that I had where this was one of the primary topics of conversation and of discussion. It was a so-called bioastronomy conference, and understanding what the history of the early solar system was and its impact on the evolution of life was extremely important to those kinds of discussions. So that's one of the things the moon has told us. In addition, the samples have told us that there are energy resources on the moon as well as other resources which are going to be extraordinarily valuable not only here on Earth sometime in the future but also to future space travelers. Just from the science point of view, the exercise was hardly trivial, and it is increasingly exciting to those of us who like to study the Earth as well as think about the future of human populations on this Earth and their need for energy. The question has to do with the contrast of the American program landing in the spacecraft in the water in the early days and the then Soviet Union landing their spacecraft on land. There are a lot of things that went into that. Yes, there was always a danger of a spacecraft sinking, and indeed one of the Mercury capsules did. Gus Grissom's capsule, as you may recall, did in fact fill with water and sink. On the other hand, the United States had a multi-ocean navy. It was a relatively convenient way to recover spacecraft. You could make them much lighter than spacecraft that you would want to land on land. We did not, in the early days, have the same as large rockets as the Soviets did. We had not focused on that as they had. We ultimately, of course, with the Saturn V, had a rocket much bigger than anything that anybody else had. And that tended to make us look at how do we minimize the mass of these payloads. But I think it was primarily a question of convenience. The Soviet Union did not have a navy. They were a major continental effort. They were much more secretive than the United States. In fact, we weren't secretive at all about these recoveries. If the Soviets could recover their spacecraft in the interior of the Soviet Union, then that was their business and nobody else would know anything about it. They had probably more problems in recovery over land than we had in recovery in the oceans. The question has to do with any interest or activity in trying to create a preserve of the moon in order to keep it, I guess, for prosperity. There had been some proposals along that line. I hope they're not really very serious, because so much of the moon is going to be preserved anyway. The parts of the moon that would be useful to us in obtaining new energy resources as alternatives to fossil fuels and to meet the demands of developing nations, if not only not our own, those parts of the moon would be relatively small, quite small. In fact, we wouldn't even know that that was going on looking at it from here. And most of the moon would indeed be a preserve. It would be of scientific interest, but not of economic interest. And I hope that's the answer that we come to, if indeed that issue is ever raised. Right now, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, I think, is very clear in that although no nation can have sovereignty of any part of the moon, the resources can be extracted for use to the betterment of humankind. And I hope that that's exactly where we head. One, maybe two more questions.
Yep. Harrison, to what level of physical fitness were you asked to achieve before you're allowed to go into space?
Physical fitness, the question has to do with the level of physical fitness before we went into space. Interestingly enough, the NASA left that to the discretion of the astronauts. But fortunately, they all had great discretion. They understood that you had to be in very, very good condition in order to withstand the strain of working on the moon. The suits were not easy to use. They were, in fact, quite difficult to use. There were other aspects of spaceflight where conditioning was probably important, and maybe some that we don't yet know how important it was. The only astronaut that I know of that at least publicly claimed not to exercise very much was Neil Armstrong. And Neil, I think, would mostly in jest, did actually say, I heard him say it, that he felt that we only had a finite number of heartbeats in life and he didn't want to waste any of them on exercise. Well, that disregards the fact that just the training is a lot of exercise. I think our primary conditioning was probably the training, even though we all ran and worked out and played squash and handball and things like that quite vigorously most days of the week. The training in that suit and some other activities was quite strenuous. And if nothing else, Neil got in shape just by the training that he had to do. And I think probably secretly he would he probably was doing some other things. I just have to tell you, about 2 weeks before launch, I was the chief scientist for the Apollo 11 mission. I was very deeply involved in the training and in acting as an interface between the crew and the scientists whose experiments were flying on Apollo 11. We actually took scientific experiments to the moon even on Apollo 11, which was more obviously a political mission. But I remember coming into breakfast, being at breakfast one morning in the crew quarters at the Kennedy Space Center, and Buzz Aldrin walked in with Neil sitting at the table, and Neil was sitting there. He knew Buzz was about to get there. Buzz was a physical fitness nut. I mean, he really was. He probably overdid it. And Neil was standing there with his elbow on the table with a rubber gripper in his hand. He was just going like this. And everybody knew Neil didn't work out on a regular. At least we never saw him work out on a regular basis. He's going like this, and Buzz came in, and I never saw anybody get redder in the face. Here was Neil exercising 2 weeks before launch. He was starting to get it.
Last question. Yeah.
Were you constantly able to recharge batteries and recycle water? I mean, like, how long could you have stayed at the time you've been so delayed coming back?
If we had had a recharge capability, electrical power would, of course, not been a problem. But we did not have the capability at that time to extract the oxygen that we would need or the water we would need from the lunar materials. Future visitors to the moon will clearly, I think, will have that capability and will be able to stay indefinitely. We did not. Our lunar module, had we planned to stay 4 days on the moon, could have supported that. You would probably have to leave a little bit of the scientific payload back, but then again, I think the men were the most important scientific payload we took, and that wouldn't have bothered me very much. Indeed, in the early planning for Apollo 17, I tried to persuade the NASA managers that we ought to plan on four excursions, 4 days on the moon. But that by then, people were getting pretty conservative, and the managers were. And they had their eyes on space shuttle program and things like that, and so that idea did not fly. But the lunar module turned out to have significantly more capability than we thought it might, say, in 1968, 69, when we were actually getting ready to fly it the first time. And it turned out it had about the capability that some of the very early design engineering said it could have, the design engineering done by the Grumman Aircraft Corporation, in what was called a design reference mission. And that design reference mission actually conceptually had the lunar module as a four-day excursion module for the moon. So we basically got to that capability even though we didn't fully utilize it. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
And that was Harrison Smith, otherwise known as Jack, Apollo 17 astronaut and geologist who went to the moon 40 years ago this week. And he was speaking at the Nepean Group of Rotary International at the Mornington, I nearly say Flemington, at the Mornington race course. And we have more from Apollo 17 coming up after this message.
Set within Lush Hope and Parklands, Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham are offering the opportunity to secure one of the most luxurious apartments currently under construction. These modern and elegant apartments, designed by leading Melbourne architect Fender Katsalidis, are located next to the Bay Road Heathland Sanctuary, offering you spectacular views of Port Phillip Bay, the city skyline and the Dandenongs. Set within a resort-style garden setting, Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham offers you large, open-style living located close to Melbourne beaches, world-renowned golf courses, chic cafes and stylish fashion boutiques. Stage 1 is currently under construction and selling quickly. To secure a new Bayside lifestyle, call Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham on 95970422 to arrange an appointment today. Sandy Hill Apartments Sandringham is a proud sponsor of 88.3 Southern FM.
And you're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. And one of the things that Apollo 17 went to the moon for was to look for different types of rock, different types of soil, in order to find out more about the moon's history. And when they found orange soil, boy, were they excited.
They would sample several locations on this EVA, but none would cause more excitement than the find at the crater called Shorty.
Oh, hey! There is orange soil! Well, don't move it till I see it. It's all over! Orange! Don't move it till I see it. I've stirred it up with my feet. Hey, it is! I can see it from here! It's orange! Fantastic, sports fans. It's drift time. Jack, that is really orange.
think this is the most exciting we've come across since the beginning of the Apollo program. I believe that it's going to be the most rewarding of all the finds on Apollo.
Light gray material on either side. Oh, man, that's incredible. Hey, Gene, we're going to have to...
There isn't enough time, Tony, to do it, no matter which way you want to do it. We need more time. We may have to flip. We have to solidify them a little bit.
He's getting about 3 centimeters away.
They got to leave at a certain time, regardless of what we got.
Willing to give up all the light mantle stuff.
They had to leave Shorty Crater and its orange soil and push on. Time. The enemy of the lunar investigator on the moon and on Earth.
I can't believe we sampled the whole thing.
The precious minutes had run out. Return to the rover, drive back to the Challenger, close out EVA 2.
Now, during his visit to the Melbourne area, Harrison Smith also visited the Redback Brewery Hotel at a function organised by the Scientists Media Group. And he answered a number of questions there, and one of them, of course, related to, do we need to go back to the moon before we go on to Mars? And here's how that...
Well, my elevator speech is that I think we have to go back by way of the moon. Because that's the only way I know we're going to get the infrastructure developed, technological infrastructure, to continue to operate in deep space. The moon has the resources that may pay for that through investors or through governments. I suspect investors more likely. And once we have that infrastructure for the moon reestablished, then clearly planning and implementation of going to Mars, it becomes far less costly. And I think much more feasible than it is today. In addition, a part of that technology base is a fusion rocket, or at least fusion that can be used in a rocket form, and that then opens up some very, very interesting acceleration-deceleration scenarios for human trips to Mars that cut the time and therefore solve or help to mitigate some of the biomedical issues, which we don't know a lot about yet, but still would obviously mitigate those, and also would create a more varied scenario for actually how long you stay on the early missions and what you do when you're there.
The problem with fusion power, of course, that no one knows quite how to do it at the moment. Well, let's have another listen to the Apollo 17 mission. This time, the astronauts are returning from their moonwalks. They did 3 of them, remember, returning to the Challenger, and they did a ceremony there.
Once more it was time. Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt returned to the rover to drive back to Challenger. But before they left the surface of the moon, there would be a brief ceremony.
It's a rock. Composed of many fragments of many sizes and many shapes. When we return this rock or some of the others like it to Houston, we'd like to share a piece of this rock with so many of the countries throughout the world. We hope that this will be a symbol of what our feelings are, what the feelings of the Apollo program are, and a symbol of mankind that we can live in peace and harmony in the future.
And a final word from the last man on the moon.
I'd like to just let what I believe history will record, that America's challenge of today has forged man's destiny of tomorrow.
Words on the moon as they prepared to re-enter the Challenger.
For local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
And we now return our attention back to the Nepean group of Rotary International and the visit there of Harrison Schmidt. Now, Bruce Bilson helped organise this visit, and they did it to raise funds for an organisation called Polio Plus. And it's only fair to give Bruce a little say about what that is and why we should donate to it.
Well, thank you very much, and I really in particular want to congratulate the Coalition of Rotary Clubs that has made this evening possible and has done such a remarkable collection of resources for the fight against polio and indeed the eradication of polio. As I grew up as a child in Silver City, New Mexico, a small mining town in the southwestern part of that state in the United States, I can well remember the polio epidemics of that time and how theaters and swimming pools and everything were closed. And to think that now you are in a position where these kinds of contributions can actually be aimed at total eradication is unbelievable, that that would happen in a lifetime. A lot of unbelievable things have happened, but few that could be considered more important than that. One of the things that I'm sure you all realize, and I just began to realize a year or so ago, is that there is a generation of people on this planet who suffer from polio during those early years, who now are suffering from the secondary effects. And it's another program or problem that we're going to have to look at, I think, in the future very, very carefully. One of the problems with language was illustrated to my wife some years ago when she was checking into a hotel in London, I believe it was. And after checking in and everything, the male clerk at the desk asked her if she wanted to be knocked up in the morning. Doing several double takes, she finally realized that it was not a proposal. At least we don't think it was. The another thing that the whole evening has reminded me of is my father's experiences with Rotary. He was not a Rotarian in this little town in New Mexico, but he was sort of on call for programs. My father had the unusual propensity to try to become an expert in all sorts of new things. And every time he felt like he was expert enough, he would let the program chairman know, and they would invite him down to talk about meteorology, in addition to his field of geology, psychology, just about anything you can imagine, he would start to become expert in. And even though he never really felt like he was in town often enough to be a full Rotarian, he nevertheless was made an honorary Rotarian, an honor which he treasured as much as I think anything that he ever did. And he was a very prominent economic geologist in his own time. And finally, the discussion of my Senate career couldn't help but remind me, since this has been partially a space evening tonight, that the first editorial cartoon that was put together by one of our best editorial cartoonists in Albuquerque after my election had me with my head sticking out of a spacecraft circling the United States Capitol. And the balloon was that, Houston, I've looked for intelligent life and found none. Once again, thank all of you particularly for what you're doing in this fight to eradicate polio. It's an unbelievable effort that you put on, and I understand you did pretty well tonight with the auction.
We did. Thank you, Harrison. If you could join with me in thanking Harrison Schmidt, a remarkable individual, one of 12 of our species who in the history of mankind has walked on the moon. A remarkable feat, an adventure, a journey of discovery. We admire you greatly for what you've done. We're very grateful for your time this evening and for your contribution to making this evening a success. It's my pleasure on behalf of the organising committee to present this silver platter to you, Harrison, engraved Dr. Harrison Schmidt, in appreciation of your support for Rotary International Polio Pus, 17th of July 2002, Nepean Group District 9820, Rotary International Australia. Thank you very much, sir. Just before we close,